And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we're going to talk about the new HBO comedy series, Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. After that, you know, we've waited, we feel, long enough that we're not going to ruin your lives if we do talk about The Cabin in the Woods.
We might.
And then, of course, we will talk about what's making us happy this week. Now, last week, we had a guest panel in, so this week, we brought back Pop Culture Happy Hour Classic. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully happy to see all of you again. Well,
finally, the great women experiment
The terrible women experiment.
I like what you've done the place. The listener should know that every lamp in this place now has a red shawl thrown over it.
Yeah,
and I like that over in the corner there with the pillows.
Yeah.
And is that henna on your hand, young lady?
And we did hang some curtains.
Good. We do all have microphone cozies.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for God's At any rate, while you were gone, we talked about an HBO comedy series called Girls that premiered last Sunday night. And yet another HBO comedy series has launched.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is called Veep, and it stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And we all watched it.
Yes, we did.
We did.
Now, Veep, if you have not heard about it, is a comedy from Armando Iannucci, who also made In the Loop, the political satire you may have seen, as well as a bunch of highly regarded British television. And in it, Julia Louis-Dreyfus plays a woman named Selina Meyer, who's the vice president of the United States, to an unseen president. And she and her staff get into various scrapes and struggles and backroom arguing. So, Stephen, I heard that you were a fan of this show.
Yeah, I've seen the first three episodes and just absolutely loved it. First of all, just a marvelous cast. You know, in addition to Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's very, very funny, you have her sort of coterie of advisors who are enormously funny. Anna Schlumsky, Matt Walsh, who my brain recognizes every time as, hey, it's Louis C.K.
Right.
But it isn't.
And, of course, Tony Hale, TV's Buster, from Arrested Development, uh-huh, who is always funny. And I actually really like the fact that it doesn't come from any kind of political point of view, mm-hmm, the fact that she could just as easily be a Democrat or a Republican. Mm-hmm. It's not sort of setting up kind of broadsides against one point of view or another. It's just basically a wacky workplace comedy.
Exactly.
It's not set up for a particular amount of realism, because obviously she's giving speeches that go ridiculously awry, mm-hmm, in ways that you never see a political figure
not
of that magnitude.
Not quite that bad, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't see a political figure of that magnitude making gaffes at the rate, obviously, mm-hmm, that this character makes gaffes.
Well, you see some, but of the magnitude, yes, I would say, but maybe not of the frequency.
Right. But ultimately, I just came down on the side of finding it just enormously great fun and a show that I intend to revisit.
When I heard that the producers had set out that they were not going to reveal the political party and not going to show the president, that worried me, because normally when you have such broad political satire, you end up in the realm of your Mark Russell's press conference rag, and God forbid the Capitol steps. But this isn't toothless like that. This is very specific, and I think it is a workplace comedy first and a political satire second, because the situations that we're dealing with here are more about a giant institution that kind of locks all these characters into a very specific mode. Everybody has a very prescribed role, and what they're striving for in this particular show is basic competence.
Right.
And the comedy comes from the fact that they can't even achieve that. And in the middle of it, and this is what I think the show does really well, in the middle of it, you throw in an actual striver who really wants to just jump on these guys' heads to get ahead, and anybody in such a prescribed role just doesn't know what to make of this guy, the, mm-hmm, the character of
right. This is the one you didn't name is an actor named Reed Scott, who I think had a part on The Big C before this.
He sort of turns everyone's world upside down, in part by being A, very strategic, and B, relatively competent.
Right. Quite good at what he's doing.
Yeah.
And so she brings him on board in the first series of episodes to turn the ship around a little bit.
Mm-hmm. What did you think, Trey?
I think it's a solid workplace comedy. I think it is a political satire, but it's a satire of politics and process. process, not of issues and policy. And God, the ensemble work on this show is terrific. It's really fast-paced, and the people are playing off each other really, really sharply. And if it keeps up this level of energy, I'm going to have a great deal of fun watching it.
Question, is it improvised?
She said during her, and I'm not sure whether all of it was in the final interview, but when she spoke to Rachel Martin for Weekend Edition, she did talk about the fact that there is quite a bit of improvising, and there, that's kind of part of the style. So yeah, I believe that's right.
It feels like it, in all the best ways, that mm-hmm. it's very naturalistic and has a real energy to it.
Yeah. When I heard that they were not going to reveal the president and they were not going to reveal the political party, I was not particularly concerned, and I'll tell you why. I used to work in politics for a handful of years. I worked in state legislative politics. And I was nonpartisan staff. And when I found it depressing, it was not necessarily when people were pursuing bad policy outcomes. It was when policy outcomes seemed to be not part of the conversation at all,
right.
Which is sort of what you get from this show. And that can happen in either party. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The reason why they can do this without talking about what party she's in is that what she's thinking about, what she's consumed by all the time, has nothing to do with policy. They spend the first episode dealing a lot with this clean jobs idea right. and how she's going to do the cornstarch utensils as part of this clean jobs thing. But you never get the impression that she either particularly like is in favor of spending money on clean jobs or is opposed to spending money on clean jobs. She's doing it to get attention for herself and to improve her own standing.
Right.
And ultimately, like, her legacy is supposed to be, I'm going to reduce dependence on, I'm going to eliminate dependence on foreign oil and all that stuff, that's what she's after, but not for policy reasons, but because she otherwise feels irrelevant.
Right. Well, and any partisan moves that she's making are purely concessions in order to try to make this thing happen. She's basically just trying to grind the gears of the process.
Were any of you in this town in 1999 when the West Wing premiered?
No, I was.
Okay. I was not.
All right. This town went ape poop over the West Wing in mm-hmm. a really gross kind of star kisser kind of way.
Yeah.
They were invited to the Correspondents' Dinner, the cast and the writers, and it was always the Washington Post style section was always like, oh, Allison Jenny's at the Palm. It's like this really gross. This town has a sort of sycophantic attitude toward celebrity anyway.
And everything else.
But this was just gross. Now, I don't think that's going to happen with Veep because this isn't about the ideology and it's not about policy. It's about people striving not to screw up and screwing up.
It's not full of grand ideas. You know, I think as Stephen and Trey were both saying, it functions as a workplace comedy in which the goals are largely the same as they are in any other workplace comedy, perhaps writ a bit larger, but the goals of the vice president in this show are not that different from like the goals of Michael Scott on The Office, are, to overcome your own incompetence,
to assert some relevance.
Assert some relevance in a situation where there's a very Michael Scott aspect to the way that she keeps asking her assistant if the president has called.
Right. Oh, yeah. Say,
No.
Which is just clearly going to be a running joke.
Yeah.
Right? It's the Killing Kenny of that
one,
show.
That one truly is the thing I like least about it. It's been pointed out over and over again that it's a callback to various, famous moments in television history. Similar kinds of tropes from other shows. But that is my least favorite thing on the show.
Really? It's such a throwaway gag. And that's the thing.
But it's completely uncharacteristic. This woman is acutely aware of her own limited scope. And so to ask in front of her own staff every time as a nervous tick if the president's called.
I think she can't quite bring herself to believe that the president will never call.
Right.
The thing that kills you in a job like that is hope.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think she always feels that little bit of like, maybe he's going to call.
Right.
Well, and part of what they set up early in the series is that she was a senator and now she has been elected vice president and has been vice president for a presumably short amount of time and is still accustomed to having the level of power and authority that a senator has and has effectively been demoted to national office.
Right, exactly.
The tone is caustic. There's a cynicism to the tone. And, in the Slate political gabfest, they talked about this show, which is unusual for them to tackle pop culture, but they have every right to for this particular show. And John Dickerson, who I've talked about on the show before, very smart, very funny guy.
Love him.
And my imaginary boyfriend. really...
I wouldn't go quite that far.
Really, really took this show to task. And it was interesting from his point of view as somebody who's kind of a Washington insider. Kind of.
Really is a Washington insider.
He attacked the tone for its cynicism. His point is that cynicism about politics is easy. It's the default. The more interesting choice would be to take it in a different direction. He equated it with Baywatch. Of course, when you make a show about lifeguards, all the girls are going to run around in bikinis. It's easy. It's predictable. My thing about that is it is easy to be cynical about politics. It is very difficult to be funny about politics.
Yes. Right. Yes.
Very, very difficult. And the humor here is located in the writing, in the small character beats that something as broad as some Mark Russell or anything like that, the Capitol Steps, just doesn't have.
Yeah. For me, it is cynical. But the cynicism that it has is about the way that government currently functions and the way that it affects people who get into it, as opposed to cynicism about the entire idea of representative democracy.
Right. Right.
It's not cynicism about the idea. It's cynicism about the execution. And I think that it doesn't necessarily have to be cynicism that is inescapable, you know? The other interesting thing about it, everybody kind of gets to be both the buffoon and the victim at times. There are times when you really feel for the staff because she's being completely impossible. You know, she expects them to fix all her mistakes, and if they can't, then she expects them to somehow undo them after she's already done them. But there are also times when you're sort of on her side, when Tony Hale is following her around, telling her who everyone is, whispering in her ear who everyone is, and she gets to a point where she turns around and says, I've got moving dark shapes covered, because he's explaining to her, like, here comes a guy walking toward you with a glass of water, and she's sort of saying, I've got moving dark shapes covered. Yeah. So in that moment, you feel for her.
Oh, yeah.
And you feel her frustration and her exasperation, and
Absolutely.
You do that about half the time. So they're all exasperated and bothered, but nobody is wrong all the time.
Right. There's no one particular big villain.
Right.
No, no, not at all.
Right.
And I think
except maybe the guy who works for the White House.
Yeah.
The guy who likes to come in and just be like, I work for the White House, and so frankly, I just boss all you guys around.
Well, and who's clearly, you know, about the level of an intern.
Right.
And
we love interns, though.
Right. And part of what I like about it, as much, you know, you can say it's cynical, it's not cynical, it's realistic, it's not realistic. I think that a lot of those people are definitely types in this town.
Yeah.
And you get sort of a realistic picture of some of the sort of climbers and government types. Mm-hmm. I really loved the Matt Walsh character.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he's like her spokesperson. Who's like her press guy.
Her press guy. And who, is, again, is... I have like whatever aphasia makes it impossible to separate Matt Walsh and Louis C.K. There's this great running gag with him where he has an imaginary dog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like all he has in his life is like the picture of this dog.
Mm-hmm. It is true that cynicism about politics is easy. But finding the humanity in the people when you're being very cynical about everything they do is a little bit tougher.
And I think, you know, we keep coming back to the idea that you feel for each one of these characters in turn. Hank Stuever, the critic at The Post, sort of drew a connection between the show and Arrested Development and The Office, which we've also mentioned. The sentence he used that I think is my favorite sentence I've read about this show. He says, it transacts in awkwardness in a way that summons the oddest sort of cringing sympathy for its characters.
Right.
And
of course.
I really quite like that.
And I like the fact that that is all done from the standpoint of this office that is supposedly so close.
Right.
One of the things that Julia Louis-Dreyfus said was this idea of so close and yet so far, which makes her incredibly frustrated all the time, creates this feeling of like she has access, theoretically, to all these resources, but she has no function.
Right.
I mean, she's theoretically the second most powerful person in the country.
Right.
But she clearly isn't
at
but
all.
Not.
And you can kind of tell, and I think it is a big looming question in American politics, kind of what happens to someone after, you know, by far your greatest visibility is before you're elected. By far your greatest visibility is when you're on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens after that? One of the things that I thought was perplexing is that I've seen a bunch of people who seem to think it has something to do with Sarah Palin, this character, does not at all register that way. I think whatever you think of Sarah Palin, good, bad, or indifferent, the qualities that people laud and dislike in her are not the qualities that have anything to do with this character.
I didn't see any similarities whatsoever other than gender. And to be honest, I had not read anything about the show when I saw it. I had sort of encountered her in my brain as a Democrat. I mean, so it never even crossed my mind that she would be a Palin surrogate.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly, truly got to the end of it, and I thought about, okay, they say they're not revealing what party she's in. Do I feel like it's kind of obvious what party she's in? And then I thought, no. can I imagine these conversations taking place in either party? I think so. Mm. I do think they've legitimately kind of left it up in the air.
Yep.
A little bit. So Veep airs Sunday nights on HBO. One episode has aired. As of right now, it, like as we said about Girls last week, is currently streaming on HBO.com. You can find it in a bunch of different places or on demand or whatever, but I think we all feel like we can recommend it.
Oh, for sure.
Give it a thumbs up and recommend that you try it out and see if you like it, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And of course, if you have opinions about it one way or the other, you can come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at npr.org/monkeysee. And tell us what you think. All right, so this is the part of the show where if you have not yet seen The Cabin in the Woods and you think you ever might, you might want to skip ahead or just understand there will be some spoilers. I think you can still enjoy the movie spoiled, but, you know, obviously always better not to be. So feel free at this point. Go forward.
See ya.
See ya. Okay.
Oh, they're gone.
They're gone. Those people. So The Cabin in the Woods is a movie from Joss Whedon and Drew Goddard, who's the guy who did Cloverfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it on opening night of the South by Southwest Film Festival in a great big theater that holds like 1,200 people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to posit that is actually the platonic ideal for enjoying this particular
Absolutely.
Movie. But nevertheless, we have now all seen it. So the part that you can get from the trailer is the five teenagers get in the RV and they head out to somebody's cousin's house and the titular cabin in the woods.
Yep.
And, you know, creepy things start happening.
Wait, is it possible that among these five, is there a bookworm and a jock and a blonde and mm-hmm. a mousy girl
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and then a stoner maybe?
And well, the fool.
Something like that. Yes. Something like that. And so what you don't get from the trailers is that overarching this story is this meta story
mm-hmm.
in which the entire thing that's happening at the cabin is being manipulated
right.
by a shady from an underground bunker
worldwide government right. agency designed
agency designed to essentially sacrifice all of these kids in turn so that they can appease an angry god who lives in the earth and has to periodically have some fresh blood.
Some
have
ritual
I summed
sacrifice
it up?
Yes yeah.
show that old plot
so it's a ritual sacrifice
especially Anna Karenina
right so it's horror movies as a secret ritual sacrifice
right and it's kind of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom meets the Hunger Games meets the Evil Dead.
Yeah, something like that. It's a pretty interesting summing up. Okay, let's start with Glenn.
The thing I admire about this film is the same thing that I think it can be legitimately criticized for, which is that it tries to have its cake and bloodily dismember it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Before we even start talking about that, one thing I want to do is, in talking about this film, let's talk about Drew Goddard. I keep hearing Joss Whedon.
Right.
Joss Whedon is the co-writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, the idea is great. The writing has some good lines. But the reason the film succeeds, and this particular film doesn't bend in on itself in a self-referential sort of meta-commentary and fly up its own butt, is because of tone mm-hmm. and pacing.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
for a director to set out to do a film that constantly undercuts its own premise,
mm-hmm.
every 10 minutes, all the tension that's been built up is deliberately undercut, creating two films going on at the same time, mm-hmm. essentially. When this film works great, it works when those two realities kind of layer on top of each
yes.
other, and they're both asserted kind of at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That is a tremendously difficult thing to do, mm-hmm. and I think Goddard should be getting the credit for this, as opposed to...
It's amazing how much this film gets referred to as a Joss Whedon film.
I know, right?
Right.
To be honest, I had been told so many times, like, see it, don't learn anything about it. Mm-hmm. I did not even see the trailer
yeah.
for this movie before I went to see it, so all I knew about it was Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually shocked when I was watching the opening credits, and it was like, Drew Goddard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a horror fan. Here's a thing I don't want to see on my mental screen. The image of another human being screaming as they die. Now, can we take a step back as a species and say, well, that's a pretty unpleasant thing?
And that's, what I think, part of what the movie is about.
Of course it is.
I think part of what the movie is about is sort of getting into why do we, capital We,
sure.
demand this and go to see it. And particularly, I think Whedon in particular has talked about his kind of frustration with the whole torture porn thing, in which really all you do is you go, there's a group of people and you just see them slaughtered one at a time.
Down.
And it's not even suspense. It's just bloody sacrifice after bloody sacrifice. And I think he's very much trying to ask the question. And this is where I do think Goddard, you know, is the director, and but I think a lot of the sensibility is very Joss Whedon, particularly the sort of fascination with the idea of sacrificing the virgin and what happens to the girls in this movie. I think both because the one who is closer to a virgin, although there's sort of a sly reference to the fact that she's not technically a virgin, but it's close.
Right.
Both what happens to her in being sacrificed, but also in the what I thought was a very clever move, which is establishing that one of the things that this nasty government agency has done is give the other girl blonde hair dye that also makes her stupid.
Horny.
It makes her horny. So you sort of get at the same time the creation of the blonde and the idea of the oversexed dumb person, and that's all manufactured, which I think is
And who is the first person who is slaughtered for her transgressions.
Sure. Right. And during that scene, the scene in which Jules the blonde is getting brutally murdered, in a protracted scene that goes on for quite some time, I was sitting there going, see, this is exactly why I hate these films. This is exactly right here. I was feeling superior and smug, more so than usual. And and because, you know, that was kind of clicking to my little thing is like, if you own more than one Saw film on Blu-ray, let's put you on a watch list. I'm just saying. Let's stamp like a ticking time bomb cartoon on your forehead. So I was feeling that sort of, ugh, this is this. Who wants this? Why do people watch this? And then we cut to the scene in the control room where the people who work at this vast corporation, whatever it is, are doing the same thing. And it's like, oh, I see what you're doing. You're trying to give me the violence and the gore, but you're also stepping back from it at the same time to come at. Now, I think that's why the film works, but I also think it's a little disingenuous.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, I'm very much in Glenn's camp as far as being very, very, very averse to sort of the slasher films. You know, I mean, certainly I have not even ventured into the world of Saw. You know, even as a teenager, you know, your Freddy Kruegers and your Friday the 13th and stuff like that. What I do think is sort of interesting about the genre, you know, sort of going back to what Linda was saying about the ideal way to see this movie is in a gigantic, rowdy crowd of nerds. And I sort of feel like, in a way, that horror films, slasher films, are like that in general. The idea of watching people get disemboweled sitting by yourself is very, very, like you said, it's watch listy.
Yeah.
You know, if you're just sitting there for your own personal entertainment, alone in front of a TV watching it, it feels strange. Whereas if you're in a group of people, you're sort of confronting your fears, you're shrieking at the same time, you know, when when the killer jumps
it's
out.
It's the meta entertainment.
You're confronting your mortality on a metaphorical level.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say.
No, not your freak.
Well, I was actually yawning while you're saying that.
I do think that's an interesting element of the film. I went by myself in a mostly empty theater.
In a trench coat.
In a trench coat.
I saw it in a packed house that was rowdy and yelling and having a grand old time. And I think this is a project that is very much a joint thing with Whedon and Goddard, because apparently they worked on it for a long, long time. I saw an interview where they talked about how fully they had imagined the world, and how, and I think the phrase Whedon used is, we know what's on the other side of every door. This was as part of a conversation about the possibility of a sequel. Once you've seen the movie, it will seem unlikely. But they have much more that they could explore, was the point they were trying to make. And I think that's one of the things that makes it a lot of fun to watch, is that it feels tight. It feels like a nicely constructed puzzle.
It also has this absolutely marvelously bonkers set piece, that, you know, an extended set piece late, that is unbelievably visually imaginative and worth any flaw in that film.
I think I said crazy pants bonkers. The sequence that you're talking about, not to sort of give away all the jokes that are in it, but it kind of involves just attacking the audience with sort of every imaginable kind of scary, terrifying thing. And there is a, I'm not even going to say, because maybe there's somebody who hasn't seen it yet, but there is one particular beastie that that to me is so hysterically funny and kind of puts this exclamation point on this whole sequence. And I laughed and I thought it was incredibly awesome. Now, of course, this entire thing has been set up. That's sort of the moral, is that this has all been set up by the guys working in this underground bunker. And that's why You learn when you look at the credits for this movie that Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins are in it, which, if you know the teen slasher scene,
right.
scene
you're like, wait, parts, what? You're like,
which one is the whore?
You're like, why are Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford in it? They play sort of the guys in shirts and ties sitting downstairs at the big control panels. It's obviously, that's kind of, if you think of this as a movie that's about the making of films, that's about the horror genre and the, specifically the slasher genre. If you think of it as being about that, then they're sort of the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the writer and the director. And what I enjoyed a great deal about that particular dynamic was that they had this sort of Top Gun attitude.
Mm-hmm.
The we are better at this than anybody else in the world, and stand back, interns, and watch us fly this plane.
And they're betting and
yeah.
Yeah.
But they're also sort of matter of fact. It's kind of a day at the office. I mean, sort of a workplace comedy in that way.
Can we talk about the marketing of this film, which was a very difficult proposition? I'm guessing in your theater, Linda, everybody was in on this film in a way. And nobody stood up at the end and went, that sucked. I got some of that at my theater. Guy in front of me in a Ed Hardy shirt, that sucked.
Now, well,
I was in his
right.
element. He wasn't in my
the
element.
The audience that I saw that film with was, first of all, people who are at a film festival. Second of all, people who are in Austin. Third of all, people who want to see this movie.
Yep.
Meaning most of them were Joss Whedon people.
Right.
I agree that it's unfair to make it into a Joss Whedon movie purely, but most of the people who were there, I would say, as fans, as opposed to as kind of film festival people who went to it because it was opening night,
mm-hmm.
are Joss Whedon people. So they know that they're not going to get just lining people up and offing them.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect your Ed Hardy shirt, that's what he wanted. He
Absolutely.
Wanted the movie from the trailer.
The film site Box Office Mojo collects the information about exit polls from the opening weekend of a film.
Cinema score ratings.
Mm-hmm. Cinema score ratings, exactly. So according to them, the audience was 57% male, this is of the opening weekend, and 65% over the age of 25, and they gave the movie an awful C cinema score, which is basically
failure.
It's like an F. That score, along with a modest opening, is indicative of the challenges associated with selling satire. The title and stock characters are intentionally generic, and from a cursory glance, it would appear that the movie isn't even trying to be original. A little judgy there, Box Office Mojo. That probably kept the movie from reaching a larger audience, though the group that did show up was predominantly expecting a straightforward horror movie. By delivering something much different, the movie delighted a small group of audience members,
right.
hello, while generally frustrating those whose expectations were subverted. Moviegoers, this is a little preachy, moviegoers like to know what they are in for and when they go to see a movie, and when it turns out to be something different, the movie tends to get punished in exit polls.
But the problem with that is both what they're saying, which is if you watch the trailer, you could think you were just going to get Saw 9 or whatever they're up to. That's one problem. The other problem is, if you guys didn't know who Joss Whedon was, and you didn't know who Drew Goddard was, and I hadn't come back from the film festival and said that I loved it, and even though you know I'm not that kind of person, that kind of movie, and other people weren't talking about it, you would not from the trailer have thought you wanted to see it either. And so the problem is both the people who went were not the people who were going to like it, and the people who were going to like it weren't the people didn't decide to go.
Yep.
And I've had several people on Twitter, multiple, and this does not happen that often, but I've had multiple people say on Twitter to me, I went strictly on the basis of hearing about it from you. I would not have gone to it. I would not have seen it. It is not the kind of thing I thought I wanted to see, and I loved it. It was great. It was wonderful. The exact audience for this movie,
right.
this actual movie, is very separate from the audience for the movie that's in the
trailer. The same thing is playing out on Fandango, where the ratings are,
right.
critics say go, fans say so-so.
Right.
The other thing about this movie is I feel like this is a movie that is designed to have sort of a second life in midnight movie screenings on college campuses, DVDs, it's cultists. It's a cult movie, and, as such, it's not going to have massive appeal.
Right. And on the second weekend, it dropped, but it didn't drop by as much as horror films normally do, which suggests to them, to Box Office Mojo anyway, that the word of mouth is above average.
Yeah.
It is a tricky movie to market. And Whedon said that. He was there the night of the screening I was at, and he sort of said, look, it sat on the shelf for a while. There were studio issues, financial problems. MGM went bankrupt. There were a bunch of reasons why it was delayed for a long time. And one of the things that he said was that they were incredibly grateful to have found somebody to distribute it who was willing to take on this essentially impossible task of marketing it, because Whedon said, the problem with marketing this movie is that you can't say what happens in it.
Yep.
And you can't give people really any idea what happens in it, because they genuinely wanted it to remain as much of a surprise as possible.
Yeah.
There were a lot of people, I think, trying to get that message out. There were a lot of people kind of tweeting, very much as I did, like, look, don't assume that you know what this movie is. Don't assume you have any idea whether you would like it or not based on seeing the trailer. They made this kind of movie as a way of interrogating this kind of movie.
Yep.
Almost the way, you can almost compare it, and this is going to seem very bizarre. You can compare it to something like Enchanted, which sort of is a Disney musical and also kind of sends up Disney musicals.
Right, right. There are fewer grisly slaughters in Enchanted.
There are. A lot of the birds, though. Just, in a sense, they made, you know, a Teens Go Out in the Woods movie, in addition to, as Glenn said, sort of another movie. And the problem is, if you tell what the other movie is, then you kind of ruin the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't tell what the other movie is, then all they really see is the thing that you're critiquing. It's like if you had seen trailers for Enchanted that suggested that it was done straight and not crooked, then it would have looked like a very different thing.
Yep.
So I think it is a very, very tough challenge.
I kept hearing people say, you'll like it if you're not a horror fan. You'll also love it if you're a really hardcore horror fan because of all the Easter eggs. And I would just say, I'm not a hardcore horror fan, but I got all the Easter eggs.
Yeah,
because
the Harbinger. And
those things have infiltrated the culture. I mean, it's not like they're little tiny niche things anymore.
No.
I mean, that's the thing about horror films is that they're out there. And
so
there was really nothing I saw in the climactic scene that kind of came out of nowhere. And I was trying to figure out where it was.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just a life of seeing horror trailers and horror commercials
right,
is going
to prepare
you for most of the sort of inside jokes about horror films, at least as far as I know, as somebody who doesn't see them.
Yeah. And I will say, there is a moment in this movie where a guy rises up and hits a bad guy with an unexpected weapon, and it probably got one of the biggest whooping cheers from the crowd that I was with of probably anybody, any similar moment in any similar movie I can think of. So, so I recommend it.
We
definitely recommend it. And
even though we've spoiled
go see it,
all
it
for
even
you.
Though we've completely talked about everything that happens.
Well, hey, you know what? I think you would probably still enjoy it. So, Cabin in the Woods, we recommend it. And that brings us to the final segment of our show. As always, what's making us happy this week, Stephen Thompson? What's making you happy this week?
The veritable orgy of sloth that awaits me this weekend, Thursday night, Friday night, and all day Saturday. I will be blessedly watching the NFL draft.
Oh, God.
I cannot wait.
Already? Stephen does this thing with the NFL draft.
I don't even understand why this is a thing.
Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday, ESPN shows all 32 NFL teams choosing the eligible players from the college ranks, and it is just this wonderful feast of football, kind of this oasis in the seven-month drought between football and more football. And I will be sitting on my couch administering some very, very slack parenting while I soak it all in. ESPN and the NFL Network.
This sounds to me like watching those Powerball lottery drawings in between the weather and the commercial for the local auto dealership. I don't understand.
I'm not recommending it for you, Trey Grant. It's just like 14 hours of dudes talking about football.
Okay.
These days, it's a little bit less exciting now that there's sort of this round-the-clock, breathless coverage of football and podcasting. I mean, there are these wonderful football podcasts like Football Guys where you can listen to smart people talk about football all day long, but still just being able to sit down and watch highlights of players playing football and being chosen by the
Green Bay
Packers.
So it's highlights of players playing football as opposed to these little biographical,
it's not like Olympics. It's not like Olympics, like, wow, you know, he lost an arm and then competed in the Olympics. It's not like that. It's highlights of the guy playing, and maybe he's joining your team and now your team's going to be good. I love it. It's the embodiment of hope.
He really loves the NFL draft. One year I had to read picks to him because he was on the road. I was driving.
I called up Holmesy.
Yeah, he called me, and I read him draft picks over the phone. That's how much he loves it.
And every time one was chosen by the Minnesota Vikings, I would explain that that player was going to be terrible.
Yes, it was one of the more ridiculous things I've ever done in the name of friendship. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, do you remember a few months back we did a round of America's Next Top Comeback or whatever the heck we called
it? Sure.
And where we talked about somebody who's due for a renaissance, somebody who's, you know, done good work in the past and might still have some in them if they can recapture the public's imagination. As I recall, I picked Lindsay Lohan.
You did.
And what's making me happy this week is that she looks like maybe she's going to make my prediction come true. You know, she's been back to Saturday Night Live recently. She's got a little Glee guest spot coming up. And news this week is that she's going to play Elizabeth Taylor in a Lifetime biopic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of an interesting choice, Lindsay
Lohan
playing Elizabeth
Taylor. She's been circling that for a while.
And, you know, God bless her. I hope she gets her act together and, you know, delivers a knockout performance.
She's definitely making a little effort.
So next, Kurt Gimkata Thomas.
Yep.
After that.
Yep.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
The Legend of Korra. K-O-R-R-A. This is a cartoon on Nickelodeon by Michael Dante DiMartino and Brian Konietzko, the guys behind Avatar, The Last Airbender. Now, let me finish.
Right.
Avatar, nothing to do with James Cameron. The Last Airbender, nothing to do with M. Night Shyamalan. This is the cartoon that started it all. So forget M. Night, forget James Cameron. This is a cartoon series that ran from 2006 to 2008 that does what good fantasy does, which is it creates this very rich world with their own sets of rules that are sort of asserted, but they're not insisted upon. There's not a lot of exposition. Like, that's the thing that can really kill fantasy, is just this endless need to explain the rules of the magic. But the animation is fantastic. It's set about 100 years after the events of Avatar The Last Airbender. The star, not for nothing, is a headstrong teenage girl who is not a Disney princess, but she can kick butt, and she is the Avatar, which means she brings balance to the blah, blah, MacGuffin. Doesn't matter, doesn't matter, doesn't matter. This has the four M's that I look for: martial arts, magic, maps, Maria Bamford. She has a small role as a character. She does voice work here. So does Janet Varney, who you might remember from Dinner in a Movie. J.K. Simmons, the great J.K. Simmons.
Oh, I love him.
Lance Henriksen. Does he play a character who is gruff and laconic? Why, yes, he does. Go figure. Kind of
he
a
would
reach.
Have to.
Kind of a reach for Lance Henriksen. And the great comedic actress Mindy Sterling. So this is a really good. It's great for kids. It's great for adults. Love the show, The Legend of Korra on Nickelodeon.
Wonderful.
Great.
Very, very good. Okay, the number one money making movie of this past weekend is called Think Like a Man, and it is based on a Steve Harvey advice book. And I can only guess that many of you are out already around Steve Harvey advice book, probably. But I went to see this movie on Saturday night, and I got to tell you, I really enjoyed it a lot.
I have heard surprisingly positive things
about this movie. You know, word was out before this movie opened that it was testing enormously positively with audiences. And despite the fact that it seems like it would have every ugly, you know, men are like this, women are like that, it sort of is like that, but it's so affectionate that it does not feel mean-spirited, and it does not feel angry. And you know, if you know anything about me, I am somewhat sensitive to that stuff. It did not feel mean. If anything, men take their lumps in this movie a lot more than women do, despite the fact that it's a movie by, sort of, and based on the work of men. I liked it a lot. Kevin Hart is in it. He's a comedian who's very funny. And he's a guy who could, if he did the thing he does about 5 degrees more, it would drive me nuts. But what he does in the movie is really funny. Romany Malco is in it.
The beautiful Romany Malco.
The beautiful, wonderful Romany Malco, yeah. Who was in The 40-Year-Old Virgin and has been in some other stuff. And also was
Weeds.
MC Scat Cat, by
Weeds,
the way.
Right?
What?
He was also MC Scat Cat.
What?
He...
Say it again.
The devil, you said.
He was MC Scat Cat, who is, incidentally, the cartoon cat who recorded with and also danced with Paula Abdul.
And released his solo album,
I know.
The Adventures of MC Scat Cat.
That's Romany Malco. He also was MC Hammer in some VH1 biopic, I believe it was. So Romany Malco's in it. Taraji P. Henson is in it.
Jerry Ferrara from
Entourage is in it. There are a bunch of really good actors in it. It's really witty and fun. It does have Chris Brown in it for about 20 seconds. Fortunately, he plays a complete jackwad. So if you want to ignore Chris Brown...
So it's Chris Brown as himself?
If you want to ignore Chris Brown in this movie, it's pretty easy. He won't get under your skin too much. I really enjoyed it. And look, we speak frankly on this podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was the only white person at this movie, which I thought was really sad. If you like the ensemble rom-com thing, this is your movie, and it's a pretty good version of it, and it's fun, and it's funny, and despite the fact that it's based on this kind of dubious Steve Harvey book, and Steve Harvey then turned out to have some of his own personal problems that made people sort of say, I'm not really sure he should be writing books. Nevertheless, it is a terrifically fun comedy if you're able to sort of really not take it to heart and really kind of just see. Oh, incidentally, also Michael Ealy, who was in For Colored Girls. Hmm. And I think that's the only thing that that I have ever seen him in before. Has the most amazing eyes in any movie ever. So I'm just going to say right now, worth the money just to see that. So I would encourage you, if you like that kind of movie, go see it. It has some actors that you like in mm-hmm. it, I promise. And it's good fun, and I recommend it a lot. So, Think Like a Man. I liked it. It's dumb, but it's fun. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, Mike K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you guys.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
For being back this week in your spots.
That's right, man.
Which is not to say we don't love the ladies who were here last week, because we sure do.
Well,
we do.
Sure.
But thanks to all of you for coming back and returning, and thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.